into the left center, and what a play made by the rookie Brian O'Grady.
Pitch. Oh, into right field. Brian O'Grady, first big league home run.
Fly ball, center field, struck well. Mariznick going back at the wall. Gone! Welcome back, Brian O'Grady.
And welcome inside episode 117 of Breaking Bats, presented by Not For Long Media. My name is Justin Ayers, and we have an absolute treat of an episode this week because I am joined by not one, but two of my pals. It is Brian O'Grady, Will Crow on the pod. Guys, there's a lot of MLB stuff to talk about, but I want to start, though. Will's over in Korea this year. Will, I saw on the box score this year, you had four consecutive outings, no earned runs. It seems like things are going pretty well over there, but I wanted to talk to you about just like how everything's going. It's been a couple weeks. Just like, what are the vibes like over there so far?
Yeah, it's going good. You know, I had four good ones in a row, and was maybe got a little lucky, and then, you know, got very unlucky in my last one. But you know, things are good. You know, we're grinding through. The first month is over. You know, obviously for me it's May now, May 1st, maybe April for you guys still, but you know, it's going good. We're in first place. We're playing good ball. Our best player actually came back yesterday. So they call him the Korean Mike Trout. We get him back. We get him back today or tomorrow for full games. So that's going to be a help to our lineup, and, you know, throwing the ball pretty well. James, the other American on our team, he's leading the league in basically every pitching category you can. So he's doing it really well. And, you know, just still adjusting a little bit to the food and the culture, but we're making it and having a good time.
I love that. Brian, I wanted to go to you next because in your experience over there, like what did you find worked in terms of like immersing yourself, trying to like make the most out of your experience? And do you remember playing against Kia? Like what is that team like?
Well, I mean, I was a little used to it from Japan the year before, so I was pretty open and, you know, ready to try everything. And it wasn't that big of a deal for me, you know, just from experience. But for, like I said before, and Will is dealing with a little bit, is like not seeing your family. That's the worst part. But everything else was just part of it. Kia, man. They were pretty good. We had a couple good battles with them. I went to Gwangju, where Will is staying right now. And but the thing I remember most from Gwangju was I was really struggling, obviously, as I did in Korea. And it was like right around my birthday, I think. And my manager told me he was going to give me a day off, you know, to like get away, not think about it. And we went, and there's a really good Mexican place in Gwangju. I swear, I forget what it's called. I'll have to.
I think it's called Tequilas.
It is. It's called Tequilas. That's exactly right. So we go there after the game, and it was me and my American coach and another American pitcher and his wife, and we're just hanging out, eating, and drinking some, and then. We went there. There's like a bunch of bars and stuff right there or right around the corner or whatever. And we're like, you know what? Fuck it. Like, I think it was the American's birthday was right around there too. So we're like, fuck it. Like, he wasn't pitching. I knew I was off. Like, let's go have some fun. We're like looking for, it was like a random night though. It wasn't like the weekend or anything. And we're looking for a spot. And this one place was like the second floor. And it was just bumping, like lights, music is blaring from outside, everything, you know, they got like the host stand, all that. We're like, all right, let's go in there, check it out. Dude, we walk up there, there was three people in there like together, and that was it was just empty. And we sat there, we were like, what are we doing? Next thing I know, our translators like ordered Jägermeister, like bottles, like Jägermeister and something else. And we're like, well, guess we're sitting here. We sat there till like 3 a.m. Just having a good old time. It was like, I'll never experience anything like that ever again in my life. It was hysterical. But day off next day, and it didn't help. I didn't hit any better after that, in case anyone was wondering. But that's what I'll do. That's all I'll ever think of is that.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that's Will, so, like, have you gotten a chance to go out and explore a little bit? Like, I know that, like, the Korean fans have – I think they've embraced you, because I saw, like, you know, I think your episode last time was, like, our biggest ever on YouTube, and I think it's all because of the fans over there in South Korea. Like, are you feeling the love and kind of, like, the momentum behind you over there?
Oh, yeah. You definitely feel the love. You know, Kia actually has the best fan base. I think I said this last time, but we're, like, the biggest fan, like, group in the country. So you know, when you're walking around, or, you know, like, I've been to the mall a couple times, and when you go to the mall, it's oh my gosh, and then it's like picture, and you're like, okay, yeah. So Brito's been here for 3 years, our Dominican hitter, and he is like 6'6", one of the only, you know, colored people here. So you really can't go anywhere with him, because if you go with him, it is like, he's got a little dance, and his dance is like, they all do this and yell his name, and they like sing his name, and like to Diaz's the trumpet song. So that's his walk up. So they do that to the trumpet song. And when they see him on the streets, like, you'll be like 100 yards away from people, and they're like, you can tell they like recognize him. And as they're walking towards us, they're just like doing this, and we just start dying laughing, and like, so you can't really go anywhere with him. But like, me and James, if we're walking around, we're two Americans in a rural city, like an hour or like 4 hours from Seoul. So like, they'll like double take at us, and then it's like, okay, yeah, they realize, or they start realizing you. So, we've been able to go out some places. We kind of stay close to home a little bit, just because we're in a good food area. But Tequila's is near the hotel for the away team. And, like, Brito, if we have a day off, or, like, we're at home, like, when my wife was here, we had a day off. And it was like, oh, we're going to Tequila's. So we, like, all taxied over to Tequila's. We had some margaritas, chips and queso. Like, it was like, man, this is wild that we have one of these in the middle of Korea, like a full authentic place. And, you know, the one thing, I don't know if it was there when you were, Brian, but the one thing I will not forget about this. So, like, you know, the supper, the Jesus, where they have like the whole table of like all the foods on it and stuff. So they have like a mural of like that on the wall, but everyone's holding a different bottle of tequila. And like, Jesus is holding like a bottle of Don Julio at the like Last Supper picture on the mural on the wall. And we were eating by it the whole time, and I like kept looking and just thought it was like, you know, just some decoration. I get up at the end, and I'm like, this is a full on like tequila mural for the supper. It just had me cracking up.
That's funny. I don't remember that. That's hilarious.
Mexican food in Korea is just so funny to me. I don't know why.
it's actually different, good though.
But it's good. Good. It's very good.
Or maybe it's just because it reminds you of home. I don't know, but it was good.
Might be that. Yeah. that's awesome though. Continued success over there, Will. I've been checking it out every time I see you pitch. I wanted to stick on that side of the world and talk about a guy who came over from Japan this year, Shota Imanaga. I don't know if you guys have seen this. Absolutely crushing it in Chicago this year. I know that it's kind of been the case with a lot of guys when they come over from Japan, like the pitchers, where it's like, they'll have a great first season and then they won't be able to replicate that. I don't know if it's just like the league has figured them out. Brian, I'll start with you. Did you face Shota when you were in Japan?
No, he's the one guy I didn't face. He was in the other league, and he just didn't – when we played the interleague, he just didn't pitch against us. But that being said, his fastball is really good. He's got good ride on it from a lower slot, and it's just tough to catch up with. But I think – in general, and I've said this before on here, for American hitters, the style of pitching that the Japanese pitchers have is just harder. It's different, so it's harder for us to hit. until, like you said, you kind of get used to what they throw or you face them a couple times or you play a full season over there and you get a better idea. But then those guys who are, you know, really good, like Imanaga, Yamamoto, Senga, and who's the other one? Just I can't even remember. But they all they have that velocity and those really good fastballs to go with the other stuff that you're just not used to seeing over here as you're coming up or as you're even playing in the big leagues. So it's like in the I said it for the World Baseball Classic. Like, it's just different, so it's harder for us as Americans. It's just a different style. And when those guys have the good velocity to go with it, the good fastballs, it's really hard.
Will, do you think a good fastball like Imanaga's is something that you think will be able to play long term?
I mean, I think there's definitely an adjustment period. But I think, you know, there's differences between guys who throw like 96 and don't really have the command and a guy like him who, you know, even in, you know, Japan really dominated with, you know, strikes on the corners, mixing and matching. And I think you see that from him. You know, if you watch, like, if he throws a ball in the middle of the zone, he knows it immediately, right? And like he gave up that homer the other day and he was like, before it even like got to home plate, he was like reacting. So like, he knows where the ball's going. And I think, you know, success in the big leagues gets you as far as your command does, I think. You know, there's very few guys in the big leagues who can just go and outstuff you every day of the week, right? Like, every time a guy, especially starting pitching, you know, you're going six plus or trying to go six plus every time, you can't just outstuff guys, you know, because I think, like, if you have a good sweeper, you know, an okay fastball, but you have a good sweeper and a good curveball and, a decent changeup, you're going to go at Brian, you know, as a righty. Like, you're probably not going to throw him that fastball many times, right? You're going to try and get him with your other stuff. Well, you face him a third time and you've got him twice with, you know, a changeup and a sweeper. He's already seen it. So now you're like, he's like, all right, I got you. And that's where, you know, unless you can really just outstuff guys with 20 vert and 97 and, you know, hammer breaking balls, like, unless you've got that in the tank, like that third time through, it really gets you. And that's where I think, you know, for Imanaga, I think that's where he is. He's going to be able to have his success because he has the command that goes with it.
When guys are like primarily like breaking ball, is it harder to have success like this? Because like, what happens if your stuff just isn't spinning right and it's just hanging the entire time? Like, I saw Cutter Crawford pitched against the O's this year and he threw like 20 straight sweepers in a row and it worked for him. But I'm also like, what happens if that like doesn't work out? Like, is that, if you're a primarily breaking ball pitcher, is that harder to have success?
I would say it's more fine line that you're probably walking because, you know, like, you're going to throw some that, like you say, you're going to hang them. And, like, after a guy sees it five, six, seven times, you know, you throw the nasty one, like, the hitter's going to tip his cap, right? You're throwing that one, and it's 20 inches of break, and he's swinging through it like, all right, whatever. But you throw the one that happens to be 15 inches of break, and it stays middle, and he's 85% sure you're going to throw it, good luck. So I just think, you know, your margin of error is a lot smaller when a guy can sit up there and go, hey, I got an 80% chance he's throwing me a sweeper. I'm just hoping he misses middle. I'm just hoping he leaves it over the plate. Because, like, I think breaking balls, you have a little bit more time to adjust just because it's not 97 and with riding or sinking. So, like, 85 with a little bit of movement in the middle of the zone is much easier to hit than 97 running up and away or running up and in or something, you know, like it's much easier. Like, best pitching baseball in my mind is a well-located fastball. It's the hardest thing to hit. And that's not coming from me, the hitter. I think that's coming from asking, you know, friends. I think Brian would probably say the same. If a guy can throw 97 down and away on the black and then, you know, follow it up with 97 up and in, like, he's going to have a really tough time at hitting that compared to, like, a guy throwing an 85-mile-an-hour curveball, 84-mile-an-hour curveball that's middle of the zone.
What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, I definitely think best pitch is a well-located fastball. Yeah, if you got that velocity and you can go in and out, up and down, it's just not easy no matter what. I think anytime you let a hitter, especially at the big league level, you give them that information that you're throwing a certain pitch that many times, you're asking for trouble. Because there's probably a couple pitches or pitchers who can get away because the stuff is just that electric. But in general, if you tell a big league hitter that this pitch is coming, they have a much better chance of hitting it hard somewhere else. You know, like if Carter Crawford, you get out there and you throw that many breaking balls in a row, it's like one of two things. Guys are either are like, all right, fuck it, we're sitting on this, and when he misses, it's got to start here, and when it starts there, I'm taking an absolute hack at it. Or they start going, shit, he's got to throw a fastball sometime, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but for the most part, man, you just – when guys are that are throwing that well, or you know guys have that good of stuff, you try to eliminate pitches, and you're looking at windows of where the ball's coming out, and you're saying it's either this, or I'm only swinging at a fastball, like whatever it is. That's kind of what you have to do. Otherwise, – you open yourself up to swinging at all sorts of bad pitches, and they're just dictating the at bat. And if you stand there and they paint three pitches, well, good for you, man. That's why hitting's hard.
I got something, as he said, eliminating pitches. That's a huge thing in the big leagues. Last year when I was hurt, or last year before I got hurt, I was like searching a little bit, right? Like, I'm like, what's going on? Like, my fastball command isn't there because, like, my ball's cutting. So I went to our hitting coach. I said, hey, will you do a hitting report for our hitters on me? I was like, I want to see what you would tell our guys so I can, like, this is what I need to work on right now, because it's like something's not going right. And he literally came back the next day. Andy Haynes, I think he is brilliant. I don't know if the results have shown, but I think he's a really good, like, he's a smart hitting coach. I think he does all the stuff on the back end that can prepare you. And he literally came the next day and was like, you're throwing your fastball down and away to righties, and it is on average 3 to 4 inches off the plate every time. You're only throwing it on the corner or in the zone at like 20% clip. He was like, if I'm your hitters, or if I'm telling our hitters about you, I'm telling you to eliminate your fastball. He said, I'm going to sit on your slider, your changeup, or your sweeper, and I'm going to wait for it. And I'm not trying to do damage. I'm going to try and stay middle of the field to the like middle of the way and try and hit doubles in the gap. And he was like, because right now you can't throw your fastball down and away. You really can't throw, you're not throwing it in the zone enough, but you're getting swing and miss on guys chasing it. He said, so what I would tell our guys is just stop. If you see heater, let it go. If he paints it, tip your cap. But if you see a fastball, don't swing. And that's what teams were doing to me. They were literally eliminating my fastball and then basically going, all right, we're gonna sit and hopefully he throws this slider, this changeup in the zone, and we're going to be able to hit it.
Wow. Is that the first time you've done that? Like gone to like get the hitter's perspective on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I'm doing it here in Korea too. I just asked our hitting coach. I think it's very valuable because, you know, if you're not working on something, like, what are you doing, right? You're like, other people are always trying to get better, and they're trying to, you know, take a job essentially. So anything that, you know, any information for me is helpful because, you know, the more you know, the more power you have in your back pocket. So it's something that I'll probably do the rest of my career, wherever I'm at. You know, every month, like, hey, this is what I want to see. This is where I'm at. What are hitters trying to do to me? And I want to go from there.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah, that's I wanted to shift gears a little bit because I wanted to ask, because this news just came down today about Mike Trout needing knee surgery. It's not season ending, which I don't quite understand, but he's tied for the league lead in homers. He's 32 years old. He hasn't played in like 120 plus games in like 5 years. This is really sad. I feel like Mike Trout, we're getting robbed of an opportunity to see the best player in baseball. Brian, you played against Trout, right? Like, what do you remember about just like the competitor he is, and just like how sad is this for baseball and baseball fans?
I mean, he's just a stud. There's no other way around it. He's been the best player in baseball for however long. I mean, it just sucks. You know, there's nothing you can really do about it. I was listening to him talk. He was, you know, you could tell how upset he was, and he didn't even know how he did it. He said he felt it sore running in and couldn't even remember like what happened or when he did anything. So it just sucks, man. I would love to see a full season of him healthy and see what kind of numbers he put up. But, you know, at least he'll be back at some point, I guess. But, man, it's just hard.
Yeah. Because, like, for so long he was, like, the answer to, like, who's the best player in baseball? Oh, it's Mike Trout. And, like, this year it was like we saw flashes of that old Trout. But, Will, as somebody who's never pitched against him, but I'm sure you've seen a lot of Angels games over the years and maybe even this year, like, what does this loss mean for baseball? And what's a good Trout memory you have?
I mean, it's no good for baseball, you know. You know, 10, I think 10 or 11 homers, you know, probably – you know, he was already stealing. He had more bags in like 20 games this year than he's had in the last like 1,000 days in his career. So it's like, you know, was in a place where he was playing unreal. You know, I think being with the Angels, he wanted to prove something that, like, you know, he could be who he always was and like win there for the team that he started with. And he was doing it. You know, I think it's not good for baseball. Not only because he is the best player in baseball, he is a surefire Hall of Famer, and we're getting robbed of, you know, missing out on one of the greatest players of all time to play the game, but also just like having that face opposite of, you know, the Dodgers, you know, like someone else in LA that isn't in blue, and someone who can really like take a whole team and, you know, change their season. I think my coolest memory is of Mike Trout, and I've never played against him. I've only seen him online and stuff, but is, you know, the catch in Camden Yards. It always pops into your head, you know, that he robbed that homer. But not even that. I think it was this year, like early in the season, like top first 10 games of the year. He almost did the exact same play in Camden Yards again. And that's like my most recent memory of like, oh, how sick would have that been if he would have caught that ball and like redid the moment, like what, 10 years later? Like, I was like, that would have been really cool if he had been able to do that. Like, that would have been like a staple of like who he is. Like, you know, I don't know exactly how old he is, but I'm sure he's probably 33 years old. And he probably made that, you know, play when he was 22 years old. It's like 10 years later, he's still doing the same thing, just as good. But before I stop real quick, the when you say like the getting a full year Trout, I think 2 years ago, he hit like 40 homers, right? 40 or 45 homers or something. His most recent year where he hit 40 homers, and he had like 400 ABs. Like, he had half a year, and he was like third in the league in homers. Like, we were legitimately on pace for, like, if he's healthy this year, like the last time he was semi-healthy, he went for a 40 clip, like a full healthy year. You're looking at like home run record. Like, seriously, you're like looking at like 60, 70 plus homers. And I think that's where we, like, because he's been injured, you really don't realize that. And like, we're missing out on like potential single season greatness due to unfortunate things, like stuff that he really can't control.
40 homers and 438 at bats.
I thought you were kind of exaggerating, but you weren't.
No. It's ridiculous. Like one every 10 ABs. It was crazy. It was unbelievable.
That's insane.
That's ridiculous.
And I want to say he missed like 40 games that year, maybe 50 games that year.
119 he played.
Dude.
Wow.
That's insane. Like, I mean, yeah, it's somebody said he was following the Ken Griffey Jr. career arc, and that made me really sad too, because Ken had like the, once he hit 30, he could really never be the same guy. Always was missing 50 games a year, it felt like. So that just sucks. I know the Angels really needed him too this year. I wanted to get your guys' take on something because I saw this on Sunday in the Yankees game, and I've been dying to – I just want to talk to somebody about this because I don't know if – I'll set it up for people who don't know what I'm talking about. So the game was tied. Aaron Judge is sliding into second to break up a double play, holds his arm straight out. The ball bounces off his hand. The runner is safe, and then the Yankees scored 7 runs that inning with 2 outs. They won the game. Not called interference somehow. Brian, have you ever tried doing this? If you're like, you know what? Just throw the old arm up there.
I don't think I ever have, but it is definitely used for that. I mean, there's people who tell you, you know, slide with your hands up or whatever, so you don't hurt your, you know, if you drag your hand sometimes, like, you can hurt your wrist or whatever, which I do every time, never have. But anyway, my college coach was always saying, and like when we did drills, we had turf, so we could slide. When we would do base runner drills, it was always like you had to do your hands up. So there is like some truth to you can just slide like that. But for my money, he was 100% trying to do what he did. And, you know, I don't really see anything wrong with it. If you can call it interference, but it's worth a shot because look what happened. Broke up the double play and they scored however many runs after. And there used to be – it doesn't happen as much anymore ever since they changed the sliding rules. You know, you can't really take out the second base or middle infield guys only in very specific circumstances. If they're standing right in front of the bag, it's basically the only time you can take them out. There used to be that kind of cat-and-mouse game where the middle infielders would make throws to kind of force you to get out of the way too, or wear a baseball in the face if you wanted to. And that was part of how, you know, what they were taught was they were trying to protect themselves and make the out, and the runners were trying to come in and break it up. So I kind of like it. It's fun to see a little gamesmanship going on there again. But it just looks funny. Honestly,
he's 6'7" doing that. I think he's like, you know, I've been sliding like this for a while. It's like, yeah, dude, that's just the first time you've ever had it actually work. Like,
and he's got the mitt on too for some protection, so it won't hurt.
And you feel it?
Doesn't hurt. Yep.
Will, did you see this? What would you be going through your mind if you're the pitcher and you're like, wait a minute, I thought I was out of this inning. Now I have to keep going.
I mean, yeah, it's a heartbreaker, right? As a pitcher, but like you said, you know, people get taught that, with the new rules, like I don't understand why anybody slides when you're trying to break up a double play. Now, like, you just run like he said, back in the day, they would throw the ball at the runner. And if they hit him in the face, like, hey, you didn't get down, you're trying to take me out, so what? Like, we don't care. Yeah. Nowadays, like, you got, like, literally teams are teaching full sprint straight through the bag at second. Don't slide on double plays. Make them throw the ball around you. The Pirates did it last year the whole time. And when they walked off on Gunnar Henderson, the Gunnar Henderson throw earlier this year, Rowdy Tellez, 6'6", big boy, running straight at Henderson. He's trying to throw the double play and has to throw it around him and throws it into the dugout, 2-run score, game over. It's like, they're teaching this, like, don't get out of the way. You can't, this is a cat and mouse thing. Like, you can't slide. You can't break up double plays anymore. There's nothing that says you got to slide into second. There's nothing that says they're going to call interference. So just take your 6'5", 6'6" body and run straight at second base, run straight through the bag. Like, who cares? Like, they're not going to call for interference. Make them throw the ball around you. And it's a part of that, like, all right, we're trying to get the little bit of advantage. We're trying to make, you know, every run – means something now. Every out is something like that. Aaron Judge did that on purpose. He 100% put his hand up. That mitt, to account for, is also 6 inches bigger than his fingers. Like, it's an extra half a foot. No one thinks about that when a guy slides in the second and the mitt barely beats the ball. Well, his hand isn't even close to the bag when the mitt touches. His hand's another half foot away. So, like, there's an extra 6 inch, like, that hits. Like, he didn't even feel that. They probably ricocheted, and he was like, oh, yeah, oh, that kind of hurt. Like, didn't even care, like, whatever. But, like, he did it on purpose, and everyone's fighting for that one out because, what, like you said, 7 runs after that? That's an advantage, right? Like anything to win. Like if it's not cheating, we can do it. So we're going to do it. We're going to try to exploit the game as much as we can. And that's what teams are doing. The Yankees especially, those teams that have all the money in the world and have all the information in the world and like know all the ins and outs of the rules, and they got it all figured out. They got, oh, this guy does this. Like I've heard that the Yankees in their bathroom at home, their scouting reports are on the wall in front of the pit, like the pissers. So like guys go in to take a mid game piss. Here's the scouting report. Like if this guy's tipping, it's right here on the wall. Here we go. All right. He does this when he throws his change up. All right. Sounds good. Go back to the game. All right. Now I know exactly what his change up's coming. Like they got it all. And it's what the teams that have unlimited resources, it's what they do.
That's awesome. I've never heard that before. Brian, the mitt thing is so like, that's such a good point. Like you should just get a mitt that's just like a couple feet, like a comically large, like one of those jumbo ones.
No, dudes definitely know that. They're like the mitts help because it does sometimes sliding or sliding a whole lot will, you know, just annoyingly rip up your hand. Nothing too serious, but there's definitely an advantage, especially now with replay. The mitt being longer and getting to the base. Because this is nothing to do with what we're talking about. The replay stuff's gotten so ridiculous, I think, of, like, how their guys are coming off the bag for, like, the tiniest of seconds, and they're getting called out because the tag's still on them. Like, you know, technically they came off the bag, so it's an out. But I can't imagine that's what they wanted replay for. Like, it was just for the – calls that are blatant when you look at them, like he beat the throw or whatever. So if I was running one of those organizations, every one of us would be, or every one of the players would be wearing long mitts running bags.
If I was running an organization, I'd have my own custom company. We'd be making them 3-5 inches longer. Like you're never out. You're always in there. Never out. We're stealing. We're creating havoc. We're running through second base, every bit of it.
Bases are bigger, yeah. So it just everything's just going to get bigger. That's you brought up a good point, and a friend of mine asked me this earlier today, so I wanted to ask you guys about the automated strike zone. Will, was that in AAA last year?
Yeah, it was in AAA. It's in Korea. We are fully diving into it here, so.
We interrupt this episode to bring you a word from the official sponsor of Not For Long Media and the Breaking Bats podcast, the Original Fudge Kitchen. It is a staple of the Jersey Shore with 6 locations in Cape May, Wildwood, North Wildwood, Stone Harbor, and Ocean City. The Original Fudge Kitchen makes all of their fudge in-store, guaranteeing a delicious product, so stop by and let them know that Not For Long Media and Breaking Bats sent you. Check them out online at fudgekitchenswithans.com as they are shipping fudge and sweet treats all across the country. Now back to the episode. Does it help or hurt guys, you think, coming through the system now where it's like they're used to like this perfect clean zone and then they come to the majors and Angel Hernandez is calling stuff a foot off the plate for a strike?
Well, I mean, I think hitters, and you see it in the minor leagues, is the ones who like come up through it, they know the zone. They know what the zone is. They have figured it out. You get 600 plus ABs on an automated zone for 3 to 4 years. You're going to have a really, really good idea of what the zone is, and like guys know it. Like if you watch, I bring up the Pirates because I like to watch some of my buddies play, but Jared Triola, great dude, good hitter, go watch him hit. 99.9% of the time, if it's a ball and he calls it a strike, he knows it immediately. Like dude knows the zone, like he knows the square box. Like, and I've watched him in AAA challenge calls that were barely off the plate ball. All right. He didn't lose his shell. Like he knows the zone. And these guys that are in the minor leagues and have been it for 3-4 years, they know it. They know immediately that ball's off, that ball's down. Like watch some of these young guys on like that are getting called up and that they play, go watch them and watch these borderline pitches that are off and watch their reactions. I love watching the young guy reactions. Because everyone thinks they're like, oh, this guy's too cool. Like, he's upset. He thinks he knows everything. But a lot of the time, these young guys who've been with this minor league zone, they know it. And, like, ball's an inch off, they know it. And they, like, shake their head. And you're like, this young guy is sitting here complaining because Angel Hernandez just gave a guy an extra inch off the plate. He hadn't been here for 2 days. But then you look at the box, you're like, well, it is a ball. He knew it was a ball. He knew it was off the plate. So I think it can hurt hitters, because if you've been in it, you understand it. You know where the zone is. And then for pitchers, you know, it just kind of pulls you in, kind of makes you, you know, have to throw it in the zone necessarily. But I think for pitchers, it doesn't reward pitchers for making correct pitches. Like Greg Maddux got 6 inches off each side of the plate, right? Those guys back in the day, they lived by doing this. And like, that was the game. And that's how the game's been forever. Not saying we need it 6 inches off the plate, but if, you know, I'm facing Brian and I have him 0-2 and I put a fastball down and in that I dot to a lefty perfect that misses the sideline of the zone by a centimeter, but I made the perfect pitch and Brian probably is going to put his head down and walk to the dugout and be like, damn it, he did that. He just dotted that pitch. I don't get that anymore. That's tough, because when you're doing that against the best hitters and I make the perfect pitch and I've done exactly – I did my job. I set him up and I did my job, and I don't get that anymore. Now we're in a whole different ballgame. We're like, well, where do I go? What do I do now? And instead of getting the pitch that I deserve and that I've worked my butt off for, I'm getting the one that I don't, like the backup breaking ball that clips the top of the zone in the top right corner, or the breaking ball that barely touches the line and ends up hitting the dirt. Like, I get these big moving pitches instead of the ones that I deserve. It's like, I don't know. As a pitcher, it's like, I'm not asking for 2 to 5 inches off the plate. I'm asking for the one that, like, okay, misses the side of the zone by not even a fingernail, but I did my job. I set it up and I froze a guy. I'm not getting that freeze pitch anymore. I'm not getting it because it's not on the zone technically. And that's the one I want. I don't want the backup breaking ball 0-0 or 0-2 that I threw bad and the hitter goes, oh, that's a ball. And then it clips and he's like, are you kidding me? Like, I don't want that. I don't want the crossfire fastball that I was supposed to throw up and away, and I throw it down and in, and my catcher does this, and it clips the corner of the zone. I don't want that pitch. Like, it's not the way baseball should be played. And I don't know. ABS just irritates me. I'm going through it right now, so whatever. Sorry, don't get me going.
Brian, have you ever played with an automatic strike zone?
No, I haven't, but I agree with a lot of what Will said. I think most hitters do. I don't think most guys want just a strict robo zone, because as much as we complain about the umps and, you know, them missing calls and everything like that, the vast majority of them are good at their jobs. I like the challenge system. I like having that challenge and, you know, how quick they get that done too. It's only a couple seconds, so it's not like you're stopping the game and, you know, it's dragging on. So I think that is probably the best answer, in my opinion, is to have some sort of system with the challenge. And I haven't played with it, so I don't know if – I don't even know what the rules are, if it's one a game or whatever. But – some sort of challenge system, and then you leave the umps back there, because Will's right. I mean, if your catcher's set up on that outside corner or whatever, and, you know, you put it there and it misses that zone, that automatic zone by a centimeter, well, shit. In real life, you're probably getting that call, and that's okay. Everything he said would bother me as a hitter, the ones that he was talking about that he doesn't want. So I don't think the answer is getting rid of the umps and just going full blown automatic, but I do like the challenge. I think that's for the crucial moments, or for the really bad calls where you're like, there's no way, then, you know, you can get that shot.
It just feels weird. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. What's your take on this? I heard this the other day. Someone's talking about the ABS. They said, well, every time the game ended, see, I played on the challenge system, right? I played in it last year, and no one did this. But people were saying, well, every called third strike to end the game is going to get challenged. What do you think about that? That never happened in AAA. Like, never. Like, usually.
So you're saying people thought it would and it never did?
No. So, like, that's the argument on the challenge system right now. It's like, oh, if they have a challenge left, it's the bottom of the ninth. The closer gets a call, it's third strike. They're just going to challenge it, and it's going to delay the ending of the game, like, you know, 20 seconds if it's a strike or if it's not a strike or whatever. Like, if it is a strike, they're just going to challenge it no matter what. But that never happened in AAA. Never happened.
Yeah, I don't like that argument because it's – I feel like they – it seems like it happens quick. Like, they make the call fast. So it's like if we had to challenge it and it was like they fucking put the headphones on and walked over and were like standing there for a minute, then no, fuck it. But if it's like, oh, tap my helmet, look up the scoreboard, and like 4 seconds later, the fucking pitch is right there. Like, all right, that works for me. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And usually in AAA, like, all right, it's the ninth inning. We're facing the closer. Hey, we have one challenge left. Like, if he throws a questionable ball, like, use it. Like, don't – we can't sit on this. So you're not waiting like, oh, I got this one in my pocket. Let me wait until I'm 2-2, two outs, and I punch out looking, like, call this. Like, it's like usually your challenges are gone by then. Like, eighth inning, you have a challenge left in the eighth inning. You're like, wow, we've made it. We have done it. Like, our hitters have not used them all up by the eighth. You're like, let's go.
it's a strategy game at that point, trying to figure out like if I should use it here, not use it there. I kind of like it. I feel like that should be, even if we don't have robo umps, we should just be able to challenge stuff. I don't see why that can't happen now, but
I think it's a good system. You get like three a game, right? If you get it wrong, you lose it, right? So then it's like, all right, you got to tell your starters, hey, we need these late, right? Like, our bullpen needs them. Like, the stressful times are late. Like, unless you are certain, you don't use it. And then the hitters, you say the same thing. Like, hey, if it's the seventh, eighth, and ninth, and we need it, we need one. So, like, tread carefully. Like, then it becomes a strategy game. It's like, be weary of, like, just getting up there and, you know, saying, oh, I don't, that's a ball. And then it's like a strike. It's like, hey, could you imagine? Listen to this. Could you imagine 40,000 people in like St. Louis and Cardinal Stadium, and you're the road team, like second inning, and you're like, oh, that was a ball, like whatever. And they like, it's like dotted down and away, like perfect pitch. And you're like showing up the umpire, and every 40,000 Cardinal fans are like, ha, got you. Like, see it. Like, could you imagine what you're feeling like? You just went from 0-2, and now your soul gets taken out of you. You're like, all right, I'm probably going to strike out no matter what.
I like that argument for having it. Yeah, because then you got the fans yelling at you for getting it wrong. That makes it even better. I like it.
It's great.
It'll be public awesome. Humiliation.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
You're going to have somebody who's cocky and like be like, oh, like, seriously? And then they're going to pull it up, and it's going to be a strike, and everyone's going to be like, yeah, seriously. Like, duh. It's a strike, buddy. Like, so – it'd be funny.
It's a pretty good argument. Yeah. I had a couple last things for you. Is the sophomore slump real? Is that a thing in the game of baseball that is like acknowledged that like guys are like, they try to avoid? Because I like Corbin Carroll a lot. He won the rookie of the year last year. He's hitting like under 200 this year. Like, is it just like a matter of like the league figures these guys out, or like they had this great rookie year and it's like the second year is something different? Like, I don't know. This is a phenomenon I can't really explain, but I'm just wondering from the player's perspective, is that a conscious thing? I don't know. Brian, Will, what do you think?
Take the first. I'm looking at something, looking up something to Corbin Carroll.
No, I don't think it's like a real thing. I think part of it is definitely, especially in Corbin Carroll's case, teams were really working hard to figure out how to get him out. You know, looking back at all the pitches and stuff he had last year. I mean, he was incredible last year. They went to the World Series. So they're like, this is a guy we have to get out in order to beat them. So it's definitely teams getting a book on you, but I think it's just baseball's really hard and pitchers are really good. And sometimes shit just doesn't go your way. Maybe your mechanics get a little out of whack. Maybe there was something you worked and the off season to try to get better, and it's not really working in season. Sometimes it works during spring training, and then the season doesn't really go as planned. But sometimes you get up there and guys are just pitching you really well and you're not getting a ton to hit. I mean, there's a million different reasons. It could be the pressure. He signed a deal, right? He signed some sort of extension, didn't he?
I think so, yeah.
So maybe he's feeling pressure from
before
that.
Last year. Yeah, he signed it
whatever. Maybe, I mean, maybe it's trying to repeat like he did last year in World Series. I mean, it could be tons of things, but he looked so electric last year, I find it hard to believe that he won't figure it out and get back there at some point.
Yeah, I think more mentally as like maybe a college kid that probably might sneak into your head, but like pro guys are, you know, especially after like the season that he had, you know, I think it's more of like just the law of averages probably are going to take over. Like he's probably, I think I saw before we got on, I was just happened to be scrolling. I think he was sitting like 191 right now. Right. And you know, I think the law of averages will take over. Like, you're going to look up in, you know, 5 months or 4 months, and he's going to be hitting 270 with 18 homers and, you know, 50 bags, and he's going to be right back in there. And you're going to go, well, if he didn't suck in April, he'd be hitting 300 with, you know, 30 homers. It's like, but I will say this. This is something that I saw. This is from 3 days ago. I saw it the other day on Twitter. Corbin Carroll hurt his shoulder on a swing on 7-6 of last year, right? So I think – I don't know what his full numbers were last year, but I'm sure it was over 300 with, you know, 25, 30 homers. His numbers since the swing on 7-6, 425 plate appearances. He only hit 259 with 8 homers. And he had a WRC of 105, but his barrel percentage was 5%. And I'm pretty sure that's, like, way down from, like, his full season. So basically half the year – he hit 260, and half the year he hit probably 360 if he end up hitting like 330, whatever it may be, you know. So, you know, I'm not sure that has something to do with it, but I would be very willing to put some money on it that whatever he did in that swing that hurt his shoulder went into the off season to try and figure some things out to maybe not have that happen again. And it might have worked in spring, and now we're in season, and it's not really clicking. So I saw something else where his like walk percentage may be up, and his swing and miss percentage may be down this year compared to last year. And someone was saying, but also his balls in play and his like barrel percentage is down. So maybe that swing and miss that he was trying to eliminate has also affected his contact ability, because I remember pitches last year, like breaking balls below the zone that were good pitchers' pitches that he was crushing for doubles and homers, right? Like pitches that were out of the zone. And, you know, maybe that had something to do with his formula. Like Rafael Devers, he's a bad ball hitter. He is notoriously known for hitting balls that are not supposed to be hit. He hits them for doubles and triples and homers, right? If you take that out of his game, who is Rafael Devers, right? If he is a bad ball hitter, he's hitting pitcher's pitches. Like, that's why he hits 320. Is Corbin Carroll not hitting these pitches anymore because he's taking them and he is getting these walks and seeing more pitches? But is that affecting him on the other side because he can hit bad ball pitches? He's got the swing, or he's got the bat-to-ball ability and the talent to put these balls in the gap and run for days. Like, you never know. That's something else that he might have worked on that just isn't working for him.
Wow. I'd never heard that before. That makes a lot of sense, though. And especially with I feel like, yeah, if somebody's like, they go from hitting really well 1 year to the next year, it's like, I don't know, injury maybe. But and who, hey, in a couple months, he might break out of it and we'd be just all look like dummies. Like, yeah, of course he's got that 300.
I mean, like the fastest guy in the league. Like, you put the ball in play enough over the course of 6 months, he's looking at 250 at minimal, right in the face with 35 to 40 bags. So, and I think with that lineup, if he leads off and he's hitting 250 with 40 bags with Suarez and Walker and Gurriel, they're going to win a lot of games and probably be right back in the mix. So
he just gives hope out there to all of us 5'10 people. So he's our hero, and we love him for that. Brian, I wanted to ask you, because we were texting about this last night, but I wanted to like get it on here. Randy Arozarena, this is kind of the same thing as Corbin Carroll, where he's going through it. I think Randy's batting worse than Corbin is. I think Randy's batting like 148. He came into the season with 20 pounds more muscle and his arms were yoked, and people are theorizing out there on the interweb that like that has something to do with like his down year. It's like he's too jacked. Do you think that's a thing in baseball, where being too jacked can like mess up your swing?
At a certain point, yeah. I mean, Randy's not really like tall. Dude, I don't know how tall he is, but he's not like very tall. So he when I was there, put on a 20 pounds while he had COVID and wasn't allowed to come.
I saw that.
So I think maybe for him, he might have gotten to that point where it's like, not beneficial, you know what I mean? Like diminished returns, and it can definitely alter your swing if it changes how mobile you are or how well you can move. So it definitely could be a thing. I don't really know why he would try to put on more muscle. I think he was a pretty good player without it. But I also, and I said it to you, I can't remember where I saw it, something on Twitter talking about he was like working on hitting the ball the other way and in the off season for, I guess he didn't think he did it well last year, and in spring training, and like what just wasn't working out. Because sometimes as a hitter, you try to do things to get better or to add to your swing or to the things you can do. And it sometimes can just take you away from what you do well and have the opposite effect. Like I know very well. And so it just could be the approach, could be changes in the swing from that thought of the other way, or it could be he's got to stop doing bicep curls with Yandy because they're getting in the way now. They're all viable options.
Between him and Yandy, an arm wrestling match between them would be pay-per-view television.
Yandy has the biggest biceps I've ever seen on like a non-bodybuilder. They are ridiculous.
It's huge.
It's ridiculous.
Hey, did you said that in the off season he was trying to hit the ball the other way?
Like, I saw that's what he was working on. I saw something on Twitter about him he didn't hit the ball well the other way last year or something, and he was trying to work on that in the off season. So maybe, you know, if it's one thing to do it in the cage or even off a machine, but then when you're facing big league pitching and you're like trying this new approach where if his swing got manipulated some, like maybe he's not hitting the ball as well to the pull side anymore. And that's where all of his damage was coming last year. So you take that away, it's like, well, fuck, what do we have? You know? Yeah. So I don't know how true. That's just something I saw on Twitter. I haven't seen his at bats or anything really. So
the reason I asked is I read a thing last year about Arozarena, and he hits the ball in front of the plate on average, the farthest out in front of the plate than anyone else in the big leagues. It's like on average, his contact area is a foot in front of home plate. Wow. It's like right around a foot. And that's kind of that going off what you're saying. If he was trying to add to his game by hitting the other way, well, he hits the ball so far out front all the time. Like changeups to him, the right on right changeups are terrible because by the time they start breaking and moving down in the zone, he clips them out front so far that they never get that full movement. And he just doubles or hits homers down the line. That's why they're no good. That's why everything away from him, like sweepers, sliders, are better because they break out of that hitting zone for him way out in front of the plate. Because literally, I think, and it might not be a foot, but I know it is the farthest in front of home plate is where he does like 90% of his contact is the farthest in front of home plate of any player in the big leagues. I remember reading that. So like which would lead to him being a pull hitter and hitting mm-hmm. the ball pull side 90 whatever however much percent of the time.
Will Brian and I were texting about just like the opposite of like somebody who's super jacked, like the little who'd you say, Brian? Was it like Fletcher from the Angels?
Oh, yeah, he was the first one who came to my mind, but yeah.
It was just like the opposite of being super jacked is like guys who are like my size, like out there just mashing homers. Like, I think you're seeing that a little bit in Korea now too, aren't you? Where guys who are like super small and tiny, like slapping the ball around. Like, how do you pitch a jacked guy versus somebody my size?
Yeah, well, you deal with a lot more of the skinnier, like smaller guys here who are, you know, 8-9 holes just trying to slap, or like the one hole and the 9 hole are definitely, they're like pesky little slap hitters, C10 pitch ABs. But yeah, I think you have your damage guys and you know where they do their damage, and you're very wary of, you know, being in those damage situations or damage zones for them. As to where like these little guys over here who are like, all right, they're going to see 10 pitches. They're going to try and foul off 6 in a row. They're going to try and hit a bloop to left field. Like these things are in my scouting report for those guys. It's like, all right, I'm throwing 5 pitches or less. Right. I don't really care if I strike this guy out. Like, this is not a strikeout guy. Like, if I go at him with my best crap for however many pitches it takes, it could take me 20 pitches. Right. Like, it literally could take, cause they're just going to, like, I'll throw the nastiest backdoor breaking ball. It'll be down and away on the corner, like disgusting. I let go of it. I'm like, all right, yeah, see you, buddy. And the last second, it's a half swing, sword, touch, foul off into the dugout. The whole team's ducking because it's coming in there at like 75 miles an hour. And literally the guy, like, just, he literally doesn't step out of the box, barely gets through his swing. Back on the shoulder, taps home plate, right back in. Like, okay, here we go. Like, he's ready to go. Like, he doesn't care. So, for me, like, these slap guys who are, you know, smaller, and you're just trying to, you know, get them to hit a good pitch at somebody, because they're just trying to play tennis, basically, with the bat. And, like, if you throw it high, they're literally going to put it 6 feet over the shortstop's head at, like, 82 miles an hour. But the perfect launch angle, and then they're going to get on first. And if you're not a 1-1 to the plate, they're still in second. And it's an auto double. That's literally how it is here. Like, there's a guy, my last game that I just pitched, LG. Guy's already got 20 bags in 30 games, not even 30 games. Like, 28 games, he's got 20 bags. He's their 9-hole hitter. And doesn't bunt, nothing. Like, all he does, hits ground balls on the ground. And, like, if they sneak through, good. See ya. Like, it's an auto double. Like, fifth inning, ground ball, we were playing, our third baseman was in, and he hits a little, like, fastball that's probably a routine ground ball to third, but we're playing 6 feet in because he might bunt, and it sneaks right past our third baseman. And me, I'm notoriously known for being quick to the plate. I'm like a 1-1 or less. Like, I pay attention to the run game. And sure enough, first pitch, I'm 1-1. I held for, like, 6 seconds, like, he runs this, our catcher throws it a little high. He's still second, double immediately. It's like, that's his game. And that's the way they do it over here. That's the way those little pesky guys are. It's like, slap a single, I got a double. Here we go.
Tennis with the bat got me. Yeah. Hey, you know what? That makes me feel good as a little guy that I could have had a career in the big leagues. Like some of these other guys. All right. We'll end with this. I saw a couple things in baseball in terms of like teams and guys trying to change the vibes up. So I don't know if you saw the Twins have a rally sausage. They have a package, an unopened package of sausage. Their manager, Rocco Baldelli, had a very funny presser talking about it. That like, it's anytime somebody hits a homer, they get to hold it and like walk around the dugout. And then, so that helped them change the vibes. And also the Royals, like they all wore high socks, like the infield. And they all like, I think they won a little win streak. Have you guys ever been a part of anything weird, any superstitions, like trying to change the vibes up, anything mojo related?
I definitely have. I'm trying to think of what exactly it was, but without a doubt, yeah, you go through points in the season as a team where like the vibe change is just needed, whether it's music, whether it's a show and go, whether it's something like that. You're talking about props. I mean, in baseball, you inevitably stink as a individual and as a team. It really, there's no way around it. And when those times come, you still do anything to get out of it. Oh, anything. We've the last one I remember was me personally was my American coach in Korea. He took all my bats and was flushing them down the toilet to get the bad juju out. Didn't work, as we know. But I did it again when I came back and was in Kansas City last year, and it did work for about 2 weeks then. So that was a good one. I do enjoy that one. Sometimes you just got to keep it light. You got to have some more fun and hopefully get back to playing well and winning. I love the sausage. I didn't know that. That's hysterical.
You guys got to look that up. It's so fucking funny.
I saw that. I saw that last night. It's like a frozen piece of meat. It's crazy. Just sitting in the dugout. you got some guys, like if they're personally struggling, you get the full uni shower, which is always – that one's always hilarious. Like, guy struggles for like a couple weeks and like, you know, after the game you go get in the shower and like, it's like, all right, you shower and like it's normal, right? Everyone's showering, whatever. Well, you walk in and somebody's got like, you know, they got a 12 ounce can in their right hand. They got their hat on, they're in full uni, cleats are still on and just standing under the shower, just drinking a beer, just full shower, uni shower. Seen that one quite a bit. The biggest one I think I've ever been a part of was in my freshman year at South Carolina. We had like our hitters went, we started really hot. Like we were like, I think we started like 27-0, like something crazy. Like we were number one team in the country. Like we were really good that year. Had a bunch of like double A, triple A big leaguers on that team. And we like went cold for like 1 week or like maybe like 10 days. And Joey Pancake was – he ended up being like an eighth-rounder. He's a classic human being. One of my favorites. But he had been struggling. I think he was like draft year, supposed to go like top three, four rounds, and was struggling, maybe hitting like 220. And he was like, hey, we got to change the vibes up. We got to do this. Everybody, like in the parking lot of our college baseball field, we had a bonfire, and everyone had to burn an item – from the season to get all the bad juju off. So like some guy brought like an old glove, some guy brought a hat, some guy brought cleats, somebody threw a metal bat in there. Well, Joey was the last one because he was struggling so much, and he put his jock strap that he had had for like 6 years in there to really burn off the juju. And I'll never forget it because it's like 11, 12 o'clock at night. We're in the middle of our campus parking lot, this huge bonfire, and all of us are doing like chants out there, just like burning stuff, just having a blast on like a Tuesday night and burning jock straps and baseball equipment. I was like, that's a new one. Hey, and it worked. Literally the next, like 2 days later, and it just so happened his name is Joey Pancake, but National Pancake Day is during baseball season. It's actually – it might be in like the next week or so. It's sometime in May, I think. Well, our next game was National Pancake Day, and I'm pretty sure he went 2-for-4 with two homers. Serious. On National Pancake Day. So it was like a big deal. Like Joey Pancake, two homers on National Pancake Day. And then our clubhouse, he was like, it was the jock strap. Let's go. We're all dying laughing.
Dude, Joey Pancake is one of my all-time favorite human beings. And I cannot tell those stories on this podcast, but we had a lot of fun between the Midwest League and the Florida State League. He was always one of my favorites. Joey Pancake, if you're listening to this, I miss you, man. Those were fun times.
One of a kind. I love that.
He is one of a kind.
Oh, man.
I can't believe that too. That's so funny. Oh my God.
Was his last wait? Is that his last name?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was like a nickname. Okay,
no.
It's straight up Pancake.
Instead of C A K E at the end, it's K A K E. Joey Pancake. Yeah.
The burning the metal bat also was a nice little touch.
It's like, yeah,
we threw that in there.
The old red F-150 or 5150 Rawlings bat just. torched right there in our parking lot. I was like, well, probably shouldn't send this picture into Rawlings. They're not going to be happy about that.
I think it's still under warranty. I think we can get another one. Oh God, that was fantastic. I don't know if you guys have seen the Orioles. They have a another homer hose dong bong situation, but they have a four one. So anytime it's a grand slam, they got all four of them under it taking water. So that's my favorite. But guys, this has been incredible. This is one of my favorite episodes we've ever done. Really, really thank you guys both for coming back on and for talking some ball. It's really been a pleasure.
And before we get out of here, a special thank you to the band Stick Figure for allowing us to use today's intro and outro music.